gravitational entanglement than the hamster.
Okay, thanks. So I'm going to be talking about K3 surfaces today. So I gave a series of lectures, a couple of lectures about K3 surfaces in my 4 o'clock seminar in the fall, and then I learned some brand new things about K3 surfaces over winter break, and I gave a talk in the London Geometry and Topology Seminar in January, and I said, okay, I've prepared this talk, it's more about differential geometry, I can give it in this seminar too. So what is a K3 surface? The answer to this question depends on who you are. So if you're a topologist, it's a particular simply connected four-manifold which has a few properties. So it's second cohomology with integer coefficients, happens to be isomorphic to the unique, even unimodular lattice of signature 3,19. And it's simply connected, and it's compact, sorry, of course. So Poincaré duality tells you that the first and third Betti numbers are zero, and now I've just told you everything about the second cohomology, so that specifies a lot of the topological invariants. So there's one diffeomorphism class of these, for a topologist, it would be called the K3 manifold. Okay, so it's a four-manifold, right? Why do I call it a surface? Because the second thing, it's going to be algebraic geometry. So if you're an algebraic geometer, then you're interested in a compact surface.
So what was the notation? Lambda 3,19.
Yeah, so that's the unique up to isomorphism, even unimodular lattice over the integers.
So the meaning of 3,19.
That's the signature. Of signature 3,19. Of signature 3,19, I should say. In algebraic geometry, you call it a compact complex surface with no holomorphic one forms and nowhere vanishing holomorphic two form. And that implies that the manifold is the K3 manifold. That's the theorem of Khadira. And it also implies that the complex manifold is Kähler. And that's a theorem of Sue many, many years later. So often these days the definition is given as a Kähler manifold. There's a little distinction of language that I make sometimes between Kähler and Kählerian. Kählerian means there exist Kähler metrics, and Kähler means we've chosen a Kähler metric. So I should probably say Kählerian in this context. And then if you're a differential geometer, you're interested in Riemannian metrics on this space. And in fact, the space of interest is the set of, I need another term. These Kähler metrics on this space are always hyperKähler. And hyperKähler is a shorthand for saying that the Riemannian holonomy of the metric is SU2, SP1, really, but anyway, it's the same group. And so here I want the set of hyperKähler metrics. So holonomy SP2 metrics on X of volume 1 And I'm going to circle that one because I will relax that once in a while, but for the most part, it's a volume one. Modulo diffeomorphism. Okay, so I've said everything I'm going to say about the topology of the things. This group will play a role, but I guess I will say one thing, which is that it's known, it's a fact, and it's due to, on the one hand, to Donaldson, and on the other hand, to Porchea, and, oh boy, it's embarrassing, and the other guy. not me. Okay, so I shouldn't write it like that. Yeah, it's another guy. Gosh. Anyway, he's a nice Japanese topologist, but I can't think of his name. I might have it written in my notes. So there's a fact, which is that diff X mod the connected component is an index 2 subgroup inside of the integral orthogonal group of this lambda 319. So I'm just going to write it, lambda 319z, the z's not really essential there, but we'll probably see other orthogonal groups around. And what index 2 subgroup is it? It's the index 2 subgroup that you get by you pick an orientation of a positive subspace. So as you may know, the orthogonal group for a quadratic form of indefinite signature has four components. We're kind of used to the definite case where there are two components, but in the indefinite case, there are four components, and you can distinguish them by whether you're choosing orientations of the maximal positive subspace, a maximal negative subspace, or both, or neither, right? So so it's that particular index 2 subgroup. So one of the main tools that algebraic geometers developed to study K3 surfaces was a period map. And so I'm going to do the period map in algebraic geometry first. And so to a complex K3 surface, so this is now a complex K3 surface, I want to associate a point which effectively describes, so the way it's classically written is that you integrate the holomorphic two-form. I don't think I gave a name to that. Holomorphic two-form capital omega, should have given the name, over a basis of the second homology. And, of course, the holomorphic two-form, I should have mentioned, nowhere vanishing, so it turns out that the ratio of two such things would be a globally defined holomorphic function on the manifold, therefore constant. So if I change the holomorphic two-form here, I rescale this point, and it's nowhere zero, so in fact I get a natural point in complex projective space. And it turns out that it lies in, so the image lies in a set of points, alpha, such that alpha paired with itself is zero, and alpha paired with its complex conjugate is positive. So there's actually a 20 complex dimensional space that's natural to look at. And to make sense of this, I actually should associate to X together with an chosen isomorphism between its integer cohomology and my fixed lambda 319 space so that I can make sense of this basis globally. And then you try to take the quotient by the automorphisms, this discrete automorphism group. So over here, you would want to take the moduli of K3s, where you mod it out by the equivalence. And over here, you would want to take this space. It turns out that this space is naturally identified with a symmetric space. It's O. Again, I'll do the plus. I really can't do the plus here. It's O. It's O319 mod O2 cross O119. It's that symmetric space. I guess I should have just put it here. O319 to O2 cross O119. And but then we should mod out by this gamma over here, O plus of That's the notation for the index 2 subgroup, mod O plus lambda 319z. And this map has lots of good features. It's roughly an isomorphism, but only if you kind of ignore certain unpleasant aspects like this being not a Hausdorff space and this being a Hausdorff space. So, you know, there's a very technical, complicated story about to what extent it's an isomorphism, but there's something called the local Torelli theorem, which tells you that it's a local isomorphism, and then there's a global Torelli theorem, which tells you that if you put in the right kind of auxiliary structure to keep track of all of the details, you get basically an isomorphism. So the precise statement of this is a pretty technical thing. Now, it turns out that the differential geometry version of this is a much cleaner statement. So for the differential geometry version, I'm going to take my space of hyperkähler metrics of volume 1, mod diffeomorphism, and I'm going to map such a space to, and it'll again be called a period map, the differential geometry period map. And this time I'll map the space to the Grassmannian of oriented three planes in a vector space of signature, inner product space of signature 3,19. Again, mod my same discrete group, O plus lambda 319z. And this time we know for sure that the discrete subgroup is correct because that's just taken into account. Oh, I'm left versus right, so maybe I should have had it on the... Should have written that symmetric space with a left action, sorry, if I were being very consistent. So let me just go ahead and do this. O plus lambda 319z. So the theorem of Mike Anderson says, first of all, there is an L2 metric. I can write it down if people really want me to, on the left-hand side, which makes this a local isometry. And second, if we expand the left-hand side to include orbifold metrics, and I'll say more about what that means in a minute, then it's a global isometry. So it's, over here, I should say, there was a natural complex structure to put on a complex moduli space in algebraic geometry, or really complex geometry, complex analytic geometry here. And this is a Hermitian symmetric space. Sorry, it's a cover of a... Anyway, it's a complex manifold. It's not a symmetric space, but it's a complex manifold. So this made sense as a map of complex manifolds. Here, we can write down a fairly natural L2 metric. What you do is take a path between two hyperkähler metrics and you minimize some norm squared along the path, and that's the metric that you're putting on the parameter space. And it turns out to be exactly an isometry to that space. And moreover, this space is not complete, but its completion means put in the orbifold point, the points corresponding to orbifold metrics. And when you've done that, you end up with an actual isometry.
So did you mean if you do not complete, it's not onto?
If I do not complete, it's not onto. Now, there's one small technical complication, which is that the places that I leave out before the completion are exactly the places which are fixed points for some elements of these groups. So although I'm stating it as if it were a Riemannian manifold, it's actually a Riemannian orbifold itself, the parameter space itself. And it's exactly those orbifold points of the moduli space that had been left out before you included orbifold metrics as possible metrics on the K3.
I would call that isometric embedding rather than orbifold.
It's one-to-one. It's surjective.
I mean, before you complete, I would call
before
it
complete.
Isometric embedding rather than local isometric.
Fine. So isometric embedding. I'm happy to learn how to call these things to differential geometry. Okay, so On the complex geometry side, people go further and they ask the following question. So they have this nice moduli space, which is a complex manifold. It's a non-compact complex manifold, and so in algebraic geometry, it's natural to compactify it. And over this complex manifold, well, this isn't quite true. It's true after you take appropriate finite covers, but what you're sort of expecting to find is a family of K3s, which has some kind of universal property over this moduli space. And you would like to also complete that, and there are techniques for doing so in algebraic geometry, to a family over the compactified moduli space. And this is the problem of degeneration of K3 surfaces, figuring out what the behavior of complex K3 surfaces is as you approach the boundary of this moduli space. So let me just give you one sort of qualitative piece of information, which is an old theorem of Kulikov in this case. And it's a theorem about one parameter families. And there's a technical assumption called semi-stable, which you can achieve by passing to a finite cover. So one parameter semi-stable families of K3 surfaces are of one of three types. Type one, the central fiber. Okay, so I should give some notation. Here's my family over maybe X bar over a unit disk. That's the set of Z whose norm is less than one. And then I'm interested in the central fiber X0, which is pi inverse of zero. So type one central fiber, pi inverse of zero, is just a K3 manifold. Type two, and because I passed to a finite cover, that actually includes this issue of filling in some things that are orbifolds, because the orbifold nature goes away after you take a finite cover. Type two, pi inverse of zero looks like what's called a rational elliptic surface, and then you take a union possibly with some elliptic ruled surfaces, and then you get a rational elliptic surface at the end. So it's some sort of linear chain of surfaces, might only have two elements to it, and then they're meeting along elliptic curves. And elliptic curves are all isomorphic to each other. So that's type two. And type three, pi inverse of zero is a union of some surfaces Sj. Each Sj is a rational surface. Each Sj intersect Sk is isomorphic to P1. And the topology of the graph of these, how the way these things fit together, is S2. So just to give examples, if I started out with a quartic surface in P3, that's the primary, that's the number one example, non-singular quartic in P3, number one example of a K3. Then if I take quadric, degree two, intersect quadric, union quadric, excuse me, that's an example of this. Each of the quadrics is one of these rational elliptic surfaces, and they're meeting along an elliptic curve, which is the intersection of two quadrics. And then number three, I could take four planes, plane, union, plane, union, plane, union, plane, and that has the dual graph of just a simplex. So that's what I mean by it has the topology of a two-sphere. So people worked very hard in the 70s and 80s, to learn things about this and about how the boundary of moduli worked and how things extended. One qualitative feature that I want to tell you about it is before I even started on K3, I meant to do a warm-up. So let me do my warm-up right now. And then I'll tell you the qualitative feature. So my warm-up is going to be a two-torus. So a topologist knows what a two-torus is. Okay. If you're a complex geometer, algebraic geometer, then it's an elliptic curve. And if you're a differential geometer, then what you're studying is flat metrics on the torus. And again, so these are all well-known subjects, right? So now I want to talk about degenerations of the torus. So my moduli space, from the point of view of algebraic geometry, is H mod SL2Z. And I want to complete that. And when I complete it, I get something that's usually called the J-line. And what an algebraic geometer will do is have over a general point of H mod SL2Z an elliptic curve. And then if you complete it and look at the point J equal infinity, an algebraic geometer will put in this degenerate elliptic curve in which there's a single singular point that's happened in the fiber. You took a cycle and shrunk it down, but you didn't do that the way a differential geometer would do, sort of uniformly in the homology class. You did it just at one place. And it does have a nice topological property, the total space of this family. Namely, it realizes what's known as a Dehn twist. So let me describe to you how I'm going to do what happens in the neighborhood of this point. I'm going to build my torus by taking a cylinder and gluing together the ends. And now I'm going to spin in a circle while I rotate my wrists at the same angular velocity. Okay, so when I do this and I come back to the same place, but there was this, sorry, my arms are messed up, but there was this change in the topology. And now I do that sort of radially coming in along a disk. And of course, that place where I did the gluing is going to become more and more problematic as I get in. But it turns out that if you make that shrink down at the same time, you can fill in the entire thing to a smooth four manifold. So that maneuver is called a Dehn twist, and it produces a nice smooth four manifold as a result. And so algebraic geometers kind of like this picture. In fact, that smooth four manifold is the total space of this family of complex curves acquiring a single node in that way. On the other hand, if I were doing this in differential geometry, if I were doing flat metrics, so I want to distinguish two cases. I want to distinguish flat metrics with the area going to zero in the limit from flat metrics with the area staying at one in the limit. So if I allow the area to go to zero in the limit, I'm shrinking down, I'm doing flat metrics, so everything I do around this particular cycle has to be the same. So if I want to shrink that cycle down, I can shrink that cycle down and get a limit, which is just a circle. So the nearby guy was a torus, but now I've just gone to a circle, right? Where the radial direction, the radial circle, as it were, shrunk down to nothing in that process. Well, if I'm keeping the area 1, which I'm doing in my K3 problem, then it's a little weirder, right? Because you have to actually let the circle get to infinite size. And then I do have to keep track of some location. So this is the moment to mention Gromov-Hausdorff convergence. So this is the technique that I'm going to be applying to the K3 problem in just a minute. And as you may know, when you have a sequence of metric spaces, well, I'm going to work in the pointed Gromov-Hausdorff categories. If I have a sequence of metric spaces with a chosen point in each of them, then there's always a subsequence under some hypothesis. Okay, I'm not going to worry about the Gromov hypotheses, but whatever they are, they're satisfied. Under quite mild hypotheses, there is a subsequence which has a limit as a metric space. That metric space might be a completely different dimension. It might not have any smoothness properties, but it's a limit as a metric space. But you have to choose the point to keep track of it. And you see that happen right here. If I'm keeping the area to be 1, as I shrink down the sort of radial circle, the outer circle has to get large, and to know what limit I've taken, well, that limit is essentially going to be the tangent space at some point of this actual circular limit, and so I have to know what point I took the tangent space at to keep track of it. So I would compactify, so as a complex geometer, I'm going to compactify the affine J-line to a P1, right, with just one point added, but over here, what I have to do is actually put in a circle there, where that circle tells me the direction that I approached at, so I know how I got my infinite area limit. So I'm going to be studying compactifications that are analogous to this in the K3 case, and I've already told you about the complex one, so now I want to tell you about the differential geometry one. By the way, I should have said at the beginning that almost nothing that I'm going to say is my own work. The main point of the talk is based on recent work of Hein, Chen, and Chen, Hein, semicolon, Chen, and Chen, who have been investigating these gravitational instantons, and that their work has sort of inspired me to sketch out a big picture of how everything fits together, which is largely conjectural, still at this point, But it hangs together very nicely. I think it will turn out to be true. Okay, so now I'm going to do the differential geometer's version of compactifying the space, or looking at the limits in the space. And so my starting point was this oriented Grassmannian mod the discrete group O plus of lambda 319z. And there's this is a Riemannian symmetric, a locally symmetric space, and symmetric space theory determines a natural compactification. Well, so this compactification is one I'm going to call Bailey-Borel, or Bailey-Borel-Sataki. And the corresponding class, compactification in complex K3 surfaces was of the same nature. This is a compactification of something of a form known as Borel-Serre, and I'm going to tell you Borel-Serre type compactifications for this space. This space has no complex structure, so I didn't really have an option of using the Bailey-Borel story. Symmetric space theory determines one of several possible descriptions of this space. So I'm going to describe GR plus 319 as being isomorphic to, well, there's an R plus. The R plus is some limit towards a boundary. I'm describing a boundary, and I'm not really just describing the boundary, I'm describing a whole neighborhood of the boundary in this process, but the approach to the boundary is given by this particular R plus that I'm looking at. And I should say, this is an isometric decomposition, right? There's natural metrics on these spaces as well as on this space, and those are being preserved. I've got the R plus, I've got to pick a little R, and so I've got the Grassmannian of three, oriented Grassmannian of three minus R planes in a space of with negative signature 19 minus R. Then I've got SLR mod SLR, and then I've got R2RR, and shoot. Is there not one missing? Right, one more. Sorry, I wrote the wrong thing. This is wedge 2RR. R 3 minus R 19 minus R tensored with RR. All right, so this is actually, so the decomposition, the possible boundary components in this symmetric space theory are determined by parabolic subgroups of the corresponding orthogonal group. And these are what they all look like. They induce this decomposition of the symmetric space when you choose a parabolic subgroup. And there's an R, which tells you basically the size of the isotropic subspace that you're using to pick the parabolic subgroup. So the picture is, this is a much bigger and more complicated space, but it's got, you know, ends like that, sort of codimension one ends. It has ends of several different kinds. In fact, you can also try to go to a corner. So the Borel-Serre compactification is a manifold with corners, and the corner would be sort of doing two of these kinds of degenerations at the same time. And I'm only going to try to describe what happens to you in the codimension one thing. I'm not going to try to describe the corners to you. Okay, so the idea for figuring out what the limit is based on additional work of Anderson. So not only did Anderson prove that there was this isometry between the appropriately completed space of hypercalor metrics and this locally symmetric space, but another part of Anderson's results was that if Gij is a divergent, and that's divergent in L2 norm, or if I'm realizing it here in the symmetric space norm, sequence of metrics, of volume one hypercalor metrics, then there is a subsequence. Well, I've already mentioned that there's going to be some kind of Gromov-Hausdorff limit, but there is a subsequence which undergoes what's known as Shiedrug runoff collapse. So what that means is, as you, it's very similar to what I was drawing for a torus. I take my manifold X, and I take this sequence of metrics on X, and after a while, there's a subsequence which undergoes on the complement of a finite number of points. Of a finite set of PI. So what happens is that there's some base, there are a finite number of points I had to leave out, there's some base, and then the fibers, aside from this base, are acted upon by tori. They might be nil manifolds or something, but in the cases of interest here, they turn out to actually be tori, but this is the general story. And those tori are shrinking down uniformly, and you end up with the base. Now, because we're doing volume one, right, the base is actually going to grow at the same time. We'll have the same sort of phenomenon of the base growing while the fiber is shrinking. If we relax volume one a little bit, we can actually get a glimpse of what the base was supposed to have been. So if we let the volumes go to zero at some controlled rate, we can also sort of control what's happening to the base. So the idea is that the part that's undergoing Shiedrug-Romov collapse cannot have any curvature in the limit. All of the curvature ends up getting concentrated at these points. And let me just give an example which was sort of explicitly pointed out by a physicist named Don Page in the 1970s and then by Hitchin in the 80s. And that is, suppose I take X, well, this is a slightly degenerate form of X, to be T4 mod Z2, the so-called Coomer surface. Well, already this is not a singular K3 surface, and it already belongs to the points that I had to include. So one model is that there's no shrinking or collapsing. I just take the volume one guy, but I have to put in the 16 singular points. And in fact, there's a little local description of those guys by what are called asymptotically locally Euclidean spaces. And in this case, it's ones of type A1. And each of them contributes, by a little local computation for these spaces, 3/2 to the Euler characteristic of maybe a non-singular K3. And there are 16 of them. 16 times 3/2 is 24, which happens to be 1 plus 22 plus 1. So that agrees with all the topology I told you at the beginning, that the Euler characteristic is 24 for the K3 manifold. But now that I have this collapsing idea, I can imagine collapsing part of it. So I can take X minus the singular points, and maybe minus a little bit of other stuff, and I can imagine having the collapsed part. So this is some TK, and then the non-collapsed part, which is T4 minus K mod Z2. And I'll get all of my curvature concentrated over the fixed points here. And the idea is that there are, just like there are these ALE spaces, there are very interesting solutions known as gravitational instantons. Which complete the space. So these are complete, fill in the space. These are complete, metrically complete solutions to Einstein's equation, and they're sort of modeled on this picture somehow. And the advance that I mentioned is, Kronheimer completely classified the ALE spaces some years ago. There was relatively recent work by a guy named Minerva who worked on the next class. Oh, I should mention, okay, this stands for asymptotically locally Euclidean, and that was when there wasn't any collapsing. If I collapse a single circle, so if K is equal to 1, then I'll have asymptotically locally flat spaces. Those are the ones that Minerva made recent progress on. So these have an ADE classification. These only have an A and a D classification. And then until very recently, in work of Hain and Chen and Chen, there was nothing known about further cases. For K equals 2, they're called ALG. And for K equals 3, they're called ALH. And The names there just are because G and H come after E and F in the alphabet. That's all anybody can say. Nobody asymptotically, locally, gooby, I don't know. Nobody has words that go with the G and the H. But all of these, so these are four different cases of these gravitational instantons. And we now know a lot, in very recent years, we know a lot more about them. And what I want to do is sort of plug them into this program, figure out what the limiting K3 should look like, and then try to match that with what's going on the analysis of the moduli space that I did from the point of view of locally symmetric varieties. So the ALE spaces take the form of C2 mod G, where G is a finite subgroup of SU2. But that's the most singular point. And then you can actually deform each of these solutions in some nice way. And there turns out to be a Torelli-type theorem. Did I use the word Torelli? Torelli was the theorem which said that the period maps were well behaved. There turns out to be a Torelli-type theorem for these that Cromheimer proved, which explains how you deform this structure away. And so the picture near one of these points, in fact, near the Coomer surface, is that you have the data contained in the 16 deformed points, and the data contained in those 16 deformed points actually gives you enough data to completely map out a neighborhood of the K3 moduli, the moduli space of hyperkinometrics on K3 in a neighborhood of those 16 points. So,
is there any other way to degenerate the K3 space?
Okay, so I don't know any other way to, I mean, of course I don't have to start with the Coomer surface, and this is what I'm using as a guide. Anderson proved that there is Chigurh-Gromov collapse, and so I've got to know how much stuff I collapsed. And now because I have some detailed information about the possible instanton singularities that can go in there, I think I have a pretty good picture, but there's no proof that this is the only thing that can happen. And as I said, all I'm really doing, at the best, is going to these codimension one boundary areas, and the story would be a little more complicated if my sequence happened to head to a corner in between two of these types of degenerations. Then I would have part of my torus collapsing at a different rate from the other part of my torus, and I'd have to think more about what the geometry would be. Okay, so the ALFs are also classified. They don't have quite the same Torelli theorem at the moment, and this is the part of the degeneration story that I know least about, but the ALG and ALH, thanks to this work of Hein and Chen and Chen, I do know quite a bit about now. So an ALG instanton, ALG instantons and ALH instantons are both built in sort of the same way. I start with a rational elliptic surface. So let me mention that if you're building an elliptic surface, a family of complex elliptic curves over P1, the way to do it is to write down a Weierstrass equation. I think my students think that every possible talk I give has a Weierstrass equation in it. They might be right, I'm not sure. Start with a Weierstrass equation where f of s and g of s are functions on the base, and here f of s has to be a multiple of 8. And g of s, the degree of g of s, has to be a multiple of 12 for things to work out properly. Sorry, I just said that wrong. 4 and 6. Multiples of 4 and 6 for everything to work out properly. And when k is equal to 2, I get a K3 surface for the total space. And when k is equal to 1, I get this thing called a rational elliptic surface. I'll reserve this word for a particular case of this, but in some sense, a rational elliptic surface is like half of a K3 surface. But I'll define an actual half K3 surface in a couple of minutes. So I take one of these rational elliptic surfaces. So over P1, it's got all these nice rational elliptic curves. It's going to have some degenerate ones in there someplace. And then at infinity, I pick one particular fiber. So So my rational elliptic surface is S. At infinity, I have my fiber C. And S minus C looks like a non-compact K3 surface. So for a K3 surface, you wanted no holomorphic one-forms. This has no holomorphic one-forms. And you wanted a holomorphic two-form, which was nowhere vanishing. And that turns out to be true. The rational elliptic surface has a meromorphic two-form whose pole is exactly concentrated on C. So if I leave out C, I end up with a holomorphic one-form on this space. And it turns out that for this class of surfaces, an extension of Yao's original theorem, which was proved by Tian and Yao, this implies that there exists a complete Ricci flat metric. Ricci flat Kähler metric on S minus C. So, and this metric, with a little bit of additional discussion, this metric is, it's either ALG, ALH, or doesn't collapse fast enough. And I guess what I really mean is, if you take the limit of this family of metrics as the size of the elliptic elliptic curve, the two torus, goes to zero, then you see this ALG space, ALH space, or something which doesn't, the ratio between the curvature and the size of the elliptic curve is not correct to get one of these instantaneous solutions. So, but we can do better from this recent work. We can actually specify when each of these things happens. So if C is non-singular, then I get an ALH space. If C is singular, and the limit as S goes to infinity of the J function is finite, then we get an ALG space. And if C is singular with that limiting J value being infinite, then not ALE, ALF, ALG, or ALH. Has the wrong growth condition. Okay, so all of these things are going to fit into my picture now. So in the case where I have, where I was expecting ALG, so in this ALG case, well, I can, the limit, so what happened? I'm collapsing a two torus here. So the limit is a complex surface, which is the base of a T2 vibration. And I can mark on that complex surface the points where there were singular fibers. And what I want to do is put in, at any of the points where J was finite, I put in my ALG instanton. And on the other hand, at points where J was infinite, well, it turns out that even in that case, even in the limit where I'm keeping the volume of B to zero, those points naturally in this process go to the ends of cusps. So all such points belong at the ends of cusps. And so the fact that I don't have exactly an instanton to fill in there is compatible with my picture. And I should say this case was analyzed in great detail by Gross and Wilson about 15 years ago. And so we have a lot of detailed information about the metric in this case. And what's new is that we have an interpretation of how to fill in the ALG instantons at the finite J singularities in these pictures. In the ALH case, well, so in the ALG, I just took care of the second and third bullets. In the ALH case, I just do the first. And the base is just one-dimensional. I'm going to find an ALH space at each end of this one dimension. And although I described it as removing a complex curve from a complex surface, if you think about that, the complex curve is going to have a complex normal bundle, and in that normal bundle, there's going to be a circle bundle. So the approach from the point of view of differential geometry is along the radial direction, and what you're really seeing at the end of this thing is a 3-torus, not a 2-torus. So I have this T3 picture all through here, and it's more or less a constant T3, and then I all of my curvature was concentrated at the ends, and I have an ALH instanton to fill in at each of the ends. So this is the one that I associate with in my degeneration, the Grassmannian 218 space. This one I actually associate with a Grassmannian 0-16 space. And the other degeneration, the ALF one, that's the one where I don't, where I have the least confidence, least information and least confidence about this. That one I want to assign to the space that had a GR plus 117 in it. So this is my basic picture. I've got my parameter space for the volume 1 metrics. In some cases, I'm going to want to take limits where the volume isn't forced to stay 1 so that I can get a better handle on these pictures. But in any case, I've got a particular prediction for what the behavior is going to be as you if you go in that direction. And, you know, the fact that I chose one particular kind of compactification doesn't mean that the limits had to exist in that compactification, but it's a very natural compactification, and at least in two of the cases, it turns out that the data here that I wrote down in that decomposition can be matched precisely across the two things. So that's my sort of big geometric picture of volume 1 metrics on K3 surfaces. And now I want to say two words about M-theory. Any questions before I go on? Yes?
So you just start with any rational elliptic surface?
Start with any rational elliptic surface. That's right.
What happens if you just take the...
Okay, so as in the case of...
curve times P1.
No. It has to be... elliptic curve times P1 is not a rational elliptic surface. That's not rational, because it's got a holomorphic 1 form. Rational elliptic surface really means, and with section, I think I should have said, it really means, it was written here, but it really means that Weierstrass equation with those degrees.
Nice.
Yeah, so there are singular fibers, no matter what you do. And, in the ALE case, I described this a little better. Here, I've got my instanton solution, which actually has all of the rest of the singularities bunched up someplace, and then there's some parameters in which I can let them roam around, and I can replace, you know, I can replace those parameters with the ones which I would have gotten from the original global guy, and I can model a neighborhood of the boundary, at least in terms of parameter counts, that's all that I can do right now, I can model a neighborhood of the boundary in terms of the known parameters for those instances. And I could do this the correct parameter count as well for this ALH case. ALF is still a mystery. I don't quite know how to do it there. Other questions? Okay, so let me quickly tell you about M theory. So M theory is a beautiful physical theory which lives in 10 plus 1 space-time dimensions, and involves a metric. The only fields in the theory, well, there are fermionic fields, which I'm going to ignore, but the only so-called bosonic fields in the theory are a metric and a 3-form, which is usually called C. But there's a version of a theory in which the degrees of freedom of the 3-form are replaced by an E8 gauge field. And that's the version that I'm going to describe very briefly. So one thing physicists would like to do is to take a compact manifold such as a K3 surface and formulate this 10 plus 1 dimensional theory on a space that consists of the compact manifold plus some non-compact guy. I'll take it to be the Minkowski space in the complementary 7 dimensions. So it's 1, 6. And then the data... Of course, there's still going to be a 3-form and a CIJK and maybe some other stuff coming from the process of reducing on X, but the main things that I'm going to worry about are a choice of a GIJ, and the physical theory has what you do variational work on the Lagrangian, you end up with what are called equations of motion, and the equations of motion say that the Ricci tensor is supposed to be zero. So I have one of those, and I also have this three form. Okay, that's physics terminology, right? But a mathematician would write it this way, dxi, dxj, dxk, and I want the three form to be harmonic. That's what my equation of motion say. So the presence of that EA gauge field doesn't really manifest itself so carefully on a compact manifold, but on a non-compact manifold, you end up getting, you get an EA gauge field on the boundary. So where does E8 come in? It's a little mysterious from the point of view of physics, but at least as a sort of mechanical process, the reason that E8 is okay to come in is that when you look at the classifying space for E8 bundles, it turns out to be an Eilenberg-MacLane space up to dimension 15. So it's got the topology of an Eilenberg, the homotopy of an Eilenberg-MacLane space up to dimension 15, and we're only ever using it at dimension 11. People who do anomalies might go up to a dimension 13, but anyway, they're just fine for dimension 15. So it's hard, from a differential topology point of view, it's hard to tell a three-form from an EA gauge field if your dimension is less than or equal to 15. So maybe we'll use the EA gauge field instead. Now, so the genesis of this whole whole talk today was a lecture that I gave at the Strings 2002 meeting, which I never wrote up. And the reason I never wrote it up is because it was based on yet-to-be-published work by Diaconescu, Moore, and Witten about the connection between the free form and the gauge field. And I had made some incorrect guesses based on hints that they had told me. And so I needed to wait for their paper and rework the thing. And then I got distracted after their paper finally came out. And so it's only my fault. But two things happened at that talk. One was, okay, what were the two? I only remember one. So one thing happened at that talk. which is that Gary Gibbons, a mathematical physicist who's done a lot of construction of interesting Lorentz signature Einstein metrics, expressed a lot of doubt that the metrics that I proposed would exist, and I sort of tried to explain why I thought intuitively they should exist. They were these ALH metrics, and now I'm really happy that Chen and Chen have proved that they exist. So the intuition that I was expressing in that lecture in 2002 had at least one correct piece. So here was the point. So when the what I want to look at again is a sequence of GIJs which goes to the boundary, and I'm having it go to the boundary in this ALH way, so a la ALH, right? So in earlier terms, I've got k equals 3, so I've got I'm shrinking down a family of 3 tori in the process.
Dave, how does the EA gauge get into the theory?
The 11-dimensional supergravity theory requires the EA for its supersymmetry action. Oh. So the pair come together. You hardly notice it on a compact manifold, particularly one with third bending number 0, because you don't have any non-trivial harmonic forms. And that is the mysterious part of what I'm about to tell you. So what I'm about to tell you is that you should let these fluctuate a little bit around their values while you're taking that limit, and then you'll see an EA pop up on the boundary. But the picture that I had was this. So I've got my, I've got my interesting instanton stuff, and then I've got my boring T3 stuff, and then I've got my interesting instanton stuff. That's what's happening somehow crudely as I approach the boundary here, as I shrink down this family of three tori. So remember, the cross-section here is a three torus. But I have to be taking this limit in the pointed Gromov-Hausdorff topology. So there are three basic things that can happen. I could be standing over at the left near this instanton and let everything shrink down, and then I will see the structure of that instanton. And what I will see far away from me is a single three torus. And M-theory tells me that if I'm looking at M-theory, I will see the structure of an EA bundle, EA gauge bundle, on that three torus. On the other hand, I could be standing on this side, and the same thing would happen, but it would be a different instanton and a different gauge bundle on the three torus. The gauge bundle on the three torus is encoding the geometric information at the other side of this thing. So although I lose information if I just consider the limit of metrics, when I also put in this fluctuating freeform field, somehow I recover some of that geometric information. And then my third option is to stand in the middle. If I stand in the middle, then both instantons recede from me, and I see as my sort of spatial horizon two copies of the three torus. I get an E8 on each of those copies. And when you count, you discover that the data required for the geometry of the instantons, you need two of these things which are essentially amounts to E8 data. That was my R8 tensor RR, but it was R3 in this particular case. That's the data that specifies the things on the T3s, but it's also the same number of parameters that's required for the instanton. So in that case, the data is a metric on the torus, which is visible, a two-form on the torus, which is another part of the story that helps to define the structure, and then a couple of these guys, which belong at the ends of the thing. So there's this interesting match, but there are these three different ways of taking limits, and that actually suggests, in physics, a duality with the heterotic string based on this three torus, and that's one of the expected physics dualities, and that was the point of my talk in 2002. So my last remark is that, as many of you know, I'm interested in G2 manifolds these days, part of the Simons collaboration thinking about G2 manifolds and their applications to physics. It is widely believed that there are G2 manifolds that are fibered by co-associative K3 surfaces, and if you wanted to do M-theory on G2 manifolds, which my physics buddies want to do, and if you wanted to use this duality to the heterotic string, then the natural thing to do would be to look at these limits where there are three tori collapsing. That would be on each K3 fiber of fibration on the G2 manifold. And in the end, so what I'm doing here is I'm sort of splitting apart the K3 into two half K3s, each meeting on two three tori, right? So two four manifolds with boundary, which are sharing a common three torus boundary. And what I would be doing in this more global context, presumably, of G2 manifolds is splitting a G2 manifold into two half G2 manifolds, each of which has a boundary that's fibered by three tori and is a Calabi-Yau threefold. That's what physics would expect. And in fact, those three torus fibrations of Calabi-Yau threefolds have been expected for a long time in the physics literature. They go under the name of SYZ fibration. And so what the hope is that you can build G2 manifolds by taking non-compact G2 manifolds whose boundary is an SYZ fibered Calabi-Yau threefold and glue them together and get something. And that will end.
Are there already those G2 manifolds?
Well, so in recent years, as you probably know, there have been this explosion of constructions of G2 manifolds. One of the problems is that in these new constructions, there are obvious vibrations by K3s, but because the metric is constructed by gluing and then smoothing, you don't know that those are calibrated. Probably the ones that you get from the construction aren't directly calibrated. They need to be deformed slightly to be calibrated, and that's not known. So if you assume that they're calibrated, then you could probably get somewhere with this picture, but then there's still a lot to prove.
Are there global Torelli type terms for the
ALG and LH, there are Torelli theorems. ALF is still up in the air, I think. So in all of these cases, there are some compact surfaces near the singular guy. If you deform a little bit, there's some compact surfaces, and there you can integrate each of the three two forms over that complex surface and get a triple of real numbers, and that's the Torelli data. And those numbers are all vanishing as you come to the center of the instanton. So that provides a Torelli theorem for deformations of the instanton.
I see. So it doesn't look like Kronheimer's.
That's exactly what Kronheimer's does. So Kronheimer. So I wrote it as inside of SU2, but it's not. I mean, a better description, frankly, is H rather than C2. There's no specified complex structure, and in that case as well, there's a hyperkähler structure on H. And there are three two-forms to integrate over, and you do the Torelli.
Dave, can you repeat the belief you mentioned that there should exist G2 manifolds fibered by?
There should exist. Okay, so there's a theorem of McLean which says if you have a co-associative four-manifold in a G2 manifold, it's Local deformations within the G2 manifold are unobstructed, and their dimension is the is B2 plus.
Right.
K3 has B2 plus equal 3. So it's been a speculation for a long time that the most natural thing would be you had this just nice family, three-dimensional family of K3 surfaces, and that would sweep out the entire G2 manifold. So in fact, that was McLean's thesis. I happen to know because I was there. That was McLean's thesis problem. Find a K3 manifold. Find a G2 manifold this way. He didn't manage to do it, but he managed to prove important things like the dimension of the intercept, of the deformations.
So there is no example.
There is no compact example now.
Compact.
Yeah, I think they're non-compact examples.
Compact G2 manifolds, which are fibered by K3s.
Which are fibered by calibrated K3s.
Oh, it has to be calibrated.
Yeah.
And the non-calibrated are there already?
Yeah, so like I say, this extension of the Kovalev construction, which was done by Corti et al. A few years ago, almost all of them have vibrations by K3s somehow.
They are G2 manifolds?
They're G2 manifolds. There are families of K3s on them, but there's a funny glueiness being done at some point.
Who did that?
The original construction was Kovalev construction.
Yeah, Kovalev, right.
But then there's this... this very beautiful paper by Corti. Cassini was our friend. Corti, Haskins, Nordstrom, and Pacini.
Oh, right, yeah, I've heard from them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yes?
So at some stage you mentioned non-compact K3.
Yes.
Is it something you just said, or actually just saying?
Well, I put air quotes around it myself because people throw around this term non-compact K3 and non-compact Calabi-Yau a lot, and there are different sort of restrictions on what they mean by it. This particular case where there actually is a complete metric on the space that is Ricci flat, that one to me actually has some claim to the name. Other cases where people don't know anything about the metric behavior, it's a little trickier to say.
No theorem like every non-compact K3 is scalar.
I don't know how to define non-compact K3 precisely enough to even say what that theorem would mean. Yeah. All right, stop there.